When I was young, there was a show on television called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. They would take a camera crew into the houses of famous people, and they would show us all of the wealth that they owned. And I would sit there watching this as a little kid, and I would wonder, what would it be like to live in one of those mansions? What would it be like to have all of that stuff? It's one thing to wonder what it would be like to have all of that stuff, and it's another thing to know what it's like and to have lost it. And that's the situation that Adam and Eve were in. In Genesis chapter 3, they failed to trust God. They disobeyed him, and because of their disobedience, they had to move out of the most beautiful place anyone has ever lived. Now, we don't know where they went, but it's safe to assume that if you're kicked out of a beautiful place and you don't have anywhere else to go, you're probably going to stay close by, just in case eventually a door opens, you get some opportunity to move back. Now, God had told Adam and Eve that if they disobeyed him, they would surely die. But also he told them that though they would die, they would still be able to have children. They would still have an opportunity to work the ground, and there would still be some time before they received that consequence for their sin. And so, after moving out of the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had a child. And Eve's response to having a child is kind of interesting. In Genesis 4, verse 1, she says, "I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord." That sounds more like a slogan for a Christian dating website than it does for someone who just had a baby. But I'm going to do something dangerous, and I'm going to try to guess what a woman is thinking. When Eve has her son Cain, she thinks that she's going to fix the mess that her and her husband have created. For God has promised her that though there will be this war between her offspring and the offspring of the serpent, in the end, her offspring will crush the head of the serpent. So she thinks, if I have a child, if I have a baby, he's going to grow up, he's going to crush the serpent, and we're going to get to move back into the Garden of Eden. So Eve puts all of her hope in this baby, whom she names Cain, which means acquired. It's something I have gotten. I've taken this man. And she does give credit. You know, God helped her, but Eve sees herself as the primary actor in this event. And you can't blame her. She's doing her best to try to get her family back into the Garden of Eden. By the way, Eve also had another son. His name is Abel, and we don't know a whole lot about him, but she didn't really need him because she already had Cain, so she's not nearly as excited about Abel. Cain did what his father did. He was a worker of the ground. He was a farmer, and Abel was a keeper of sheep. He was a shepherd. Now, because they were raised in a good home and Adam and Eve did as best they could, both Cain and Abel worshiped the Lord. They brought sacrifices to him, both of the fruit of their labors. Cain brought some fruits and vegetables, and Abel brought one of his sheep to the Lord. And the sacrifices are placed on the altar. They are burning. The offering is going up to the Lord. And we don't know how that they knew this, but somehow they understood that God accepted Abel's offering, but he didn't accept Cain's offering. Just imagine for a moment if the ushers in this church collected the offering. They go to the back and they separate it out and they start handing half of it back. I promise you that is not going to happen. It's a little bit surprising that it would happen here. I mean, wouldn't God take whatever someone is willing to give him? I mean, Cain is making an effort, sort of. It's pretty obvious that Cain just brought some of his fruits, just whatever he could find. But Abel, he brought his very best. In verse 4, the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. Now, fat portions were the best of the flock because they were much less health conscious, apparently, back then. Abel brought his very best, and Cain just brought kind of whatever he could find. Charles Spurgeon tells a story about a farmer who is harvesting his carrot crop one day and discovers the most beautiful, biggest carrot he's ever grown. And he thinks, I want to give this to my king. So he goes up to the king's palace and is welcomed into his court. And he says, King, this is the biggest, most beautiful, the best carrot I have ever grown, and I want you to have it. The king sees that the man has a good heart. He accepts the carrot, and then he says, I own the fields next to yours. I would like to give you those fields for you to harvest. So this man leaves the king's presence, suddenly much richer than when he had entered into it. There's a nobleman in the court who sees all of this, and he wonders, well, if this guy gave him a carrot and he gets all this land, what if I gave him something that actually was valuable? So he goes home and he finds his nicest horse, and he brings the horse into the presence of King and says, King, this is the most beautiful stallion I own. I want you to have it. And the king knows the man's heart. He thanks him for the stallion, but then he dismisses him. And the man says, wait, yesterday someone brought you a carrot and you gave him land. I've given you a horse and you don't give me anything. And the king says, the farmer was giving me the carrot. He said, you were giving yourself the horse. See, there's a way to do things out of love and faith in God that is focused on God. And there's also a way to do things that is focused on ourselves. And as Cain and Abel bring these offerings, God can see that Cain ultimately is doing it for himself. He can also see that Cain has a bad heart by his reaction. When God doesn't accept his offering, Cain's face gets flush with anger. When God approaches him and questions him about it, he says, in chapter 4, verse 7, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Sin is pictured as a massive man-eating animal, like a lion that is just outside the door of the tent. And if you go out, the lion is going to eat you. He gives Cain this warning as a way of saying something drastic needs to happen or you're about to get devoured by sin. This is a warning to all of us that evil is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. It's crouching at the door of everyone's tent waiting to devour them. And unless something drastic happens, that will be the end of us. Cain gets this warning from God, and as you would expect him to have some sort of response, but instead of even saying anything to God, he turns to his brother Abel, and he lures him out into the field where Cain grows his crop. perhaps. And as they're in the fields, Cain turns on his brother Abel. He begins to strike him and rip open his flesh and knock him to the ground. His blood pours out of his wounds. Cain leaves his brother Abel in the fields to die. God once again comes to Cain, and he asks him, where is your brother Abel? When God came to Adam, Adam fled out of shame. And then when God asked him, Adam knew that he was guilty, and he made excuses for himself. Cain feels no remorse. Instead, he says, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? You see, Abel's name means something like vapor or breath, significant of the fact that he lived such a short time. Really, in this story, he functions as Cain's brother. Seven times we read that Abel is Cain's brother, and the point is that these two share the same flesh and blood. You would expect there to be some sort of responsibility for each other. Cain feels absolutely no remorse or no responsibility for his brother Abel, instead leaves him out in the fields to die. God says, because you have done this, in verse 11, now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. That sounds very similar to the curse that Adam received in chapter 3 for his disobedience. But there's one very subtle and significant difference. When Adam sinned, he was not cursed. The ground was cursed so that it would now be difficult to get it to produce crops. But now that Cain has sinned, and because he doesn't show any remorse, it's not that the ground is cursed, it's that Cain himself is cursed. And that no matter how hard he works, no matter how much blood and sweat he puts into trying to harvest crops, he won't be able to get the ground to produce anything because he himself has been cursed. Eve had put her hope in this son Cain, who would grow up and would put an end to this conflict with the serpent by crushing his head. Instead, Cain grows up and he crushes his own brother. Eve thought she was giving birth to a serpent hunter, and suddenly she realizes that she's given birth to the serpent himself. Because the only other person so far in Genesis, or the only other being that has been cursed, is the serpent. So the author of Genesis is showing us that Cain has become like the serpent, and not anything like what his mother hoped he would turn out to be. Eve is not the only person in the history of the world to put their hope in a person. It's natural for us to think that there is someone who is going to save us. It may be a romantic relationship. It may be a politician. It may be a friend or something else. And so many times when we put so much hope in a person, in the end, we end up being let down. We end up being disappointed because people have this tendency to fail and to sin and not to live up to whatever expectations and hope that we put on them. And especially in this war against sin that began in the Garden of Eden, any hope placed on a person is in the end going to result in disappointment. We see over and over again the failure of human beings. But what we also see here is the grace of God. See, Cain's response to his punishment shows how focused he is on himself. In verse 13, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." He's just killed his brother in cold blood. And then God says, well, now you won't be able to farm anymore, and you're going to have to be a wanderer on the earth. Cain deserved the exact same thing that he did to his brother. Yet God is gracious to him. He doesn't have the heart to be able to receive that grace. He's afraid that somebody is going to kill him. Now, probably this is just showing how paranoid and self-centered Cain is, but also people lived for a long time back then, so perhaps if even Adam and Eve have more kids, which they do, they'll grow up, they'll hear about this brother or uncle or whatever named Cain who killed Abel, and someone will come seeking revenge in a couple hundred years or something. And so God, instead of allowing Cain to get what he deserves, says he puts a mark on Cain so that if anyone comes to kill him, they will see the mark and they won't kill him because they know that he belongs to God, or at least he's protected by God. Now, there's a lot of discussion about what that mark is. Some people think it's a scar or a tattoo, or some scholars even think it's God gave him a dog. I don't know why they think that, but we don't know what the mark is, but somehow it would be evident to people who met Cain that he was protected by God. God spares Cain's life despite the fact that he deserves death. God shows once again that he is overwhelmingly gracious. The theological term for this is common grace. It is the grace that we receive that is common to all of us. It's life and all of the things that we have in addition to that, that God simply gives as a gift to us, that everyone gets, not because of anything that we deserve, but because God is gracious. And God gives his grace to Cain, though he's not able to recognize it or respond to it. But Cain does have to move away from his parents. And so he begins to move east. So let's just assume for a second that the Garden of Eden is on the other side of that wall there. It's kind of helpful because you got all the plants and everything else. So Adam and Eve are probably living, you know, as close to the garden as they can, looking over the gates, dreaming about the day when they're going to get back into it. And Cain has to start moving east, away from his parents, away from the garden, and away from the presence of the Lord. Every time in the book of Genesis that someone moves east, that is a very bad thing. They are moving farther and farther away from the presence of God. And so Cain begins to wander in a region, a land called Nod, which is probably about as interesting as it sounds, but it just simply means a place of wandering. And as Cain gets to Nod, he can't do any farming. So once he has children, what he does is he builds a city, and he names the city after his first son, who is Enoch. And then several generations are born in that city. But it seems to be defined kind of by one family, the great-great-great-great-grandson of Cain, whose name is Lamech. Now, what Lamech does is, in the city of Enoch, in the land of Nod, is he marries two wives. and he has four children that we know of. And if you were to visit the city of Enoch, there would be a lot for you to see there. As you begin to approach the city on the outskirts of it, you might find a ranch. The ranch is run by Jabal and his sons. In verse 20, he was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. So they've got their little city set up there, their little tent city, and they've got cows and whatever else is included in that word, livestock, and they've learned to corral them and raise them so that they can provide food and work for them. And that might be interesting for you to see on your visit to the city. Now, if you go into the city, and if it happens to be a Friday night, you could make your way down to Symphony Hall, where you're going to meet Jubal and his sons. In verse 21, he was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. So they figured out how to create these instruments, and they're using them to make music. And if you were visiting the city of Enoch, you would get to hear this beautiful music. Now, while you're there, you may find that you want to see whatever the latest inventions are that are going to help you in your home and on your farm. You're going to want to find a guy named Tubal Cain. He's the blacksmith, and he runs the shop with his children. Verse 22, he's the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. He had figured out a way to use these metals in order to create tools. So if you are in the city of Enoch, you could find some of the most innovative and newest tools that had ever been invented. This city of Enoch is a place of culture, a place on the cutting edge of technology, just like so many of our cities today. If you're going to have a company that you want to be growing as fast as possible and be leading the way in your industry, you're going to put your company in a city. If you're in a band or you're a musician, you want to be able to make it big. You don't move out into the country. You go into the city because cities are on the cutting edge of culture and technology. But cities are also on the cutting edge of wickedness and sin. And you find some of the most dangerous places on earth in the cities. In the movie Grand Canyon, it's a story about this executive who goes to a basketball game in the city, and on his way home, he gets lost in his Mercedes, and he ends up on the wrong side of the tracks in the wrong part of the city, and his car ends up breaking down. As he pulls over to the side of the road, these thugs start driving by in their car, and you can tell that they're watching him and they're up to no good, and you can feel the tension start rising. He calls a tow truck and finds out he's going to be on his way, but before the tow truck driver comes, these thugs pull up behind him, force him out of his car, and begin to intimidate him. But thankfully, the tow truck driver shows up, pulls up in front of the car, and gets out, and he talks to one of the thugs, and he says, things are not supposed to be this way. He should be able to call for help and not have to worry for his life, and I should be able to do my job without you interfering. He says, everything should be different than it is now. When you go into the city in the wrong parts, and every single city has them, you find these dangerous places. They're all over the place, even close to us. As far as I know, there's none here in Marblehead, because I think, you know, we're not a city of enough size. But if we were, we would get some of those places. And no matter whatever the most dangerous part of any city that you can think of is, it wasn't nearly as dangerous as the city of Enoch in the land of Nod, because it was ruled by a brutal man named Lamech. He had no regard for God's institution of marriage, taking two wives, and he had no regard for human life. He says to his wives, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. You see, if anyone tried to come up against Lamech, no matter how old they were or how much damage they were able to do, if they just landed one blow on Lamech, he would take revenge 77 times as badly as they had hurt him. Lamech is a murderer who doesn't care about human life. He has no regard for anyone but himself, and he rules the city of Enoch. Now, Lamech is the seventh generation from Adam, descended through Cain. He is the completion of Cain's sin. The full extent of it is shown in this city of people who have wandered away from God, build this city that may have great things in it, but ultimately is a place of violence and of evil. And you see the full extent of the wages of sin. Back home at the ranch, Eve is wondering what she has done. She has brought this man into this world who has built this city that she wouldn't even go anywhere near. Any attempt by human beings to try to fight this war against sin, to try to clean up this mess that has been created, will only result in greater wickedness and more evil. Romans chapter 6, verse 23 says that the wages of sin is death. The harder we work, because every deed we do is tainted by sin, the more and more deserving of death we become. And you see that in this city. It feels so hopeless. What could we possibly do if whatever effort we make is just going to make matters worse? What hope is there? Eve realizes that her hope is only in the Lord. Notice her response to her third son's birth. In verse 25, Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another offspring instead of Abel, for Cain killed him. When Cain was born, she said, I have gotten a man. When Seth was born, she said, God has given me this child, this offspring. She realizes he is a gift from God, and that any success she has, any progress that is going to be made, is only from him. When Seth has a son named Enosh, something interesting happens. The end of verse 26. At that time, people began to call upon the name of the Lord. Now, up to this point, they knew the Lord, and they were worshiping him in some form, but it seems that these particular descendants, through Seth, began to formalize their worship. They began to seek the Lord earnestly, not only in worship, but also in prayer. Because I think they're people who realize that any effort they make in the war against sin will result in disappointment. But if God begins to act, then they will be saved. The war against sin will not be won through human effort, but through God's action. The people of Israel realize this over and over again. They're enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. A baby named Moses is born, grows up in Pharaoh's court, realizes suddenly that his people are enslaved, and he goes out one day and decides that he's going to be the one to free them. He sees an Egyptian beating one of the Hebrews. He kills the Egyptian, thinking that it's going to be his power and his effort that saves his people. Instead, he gets run out of the country, and he spends 40 years in the desert until God makes sure that Moses knows that he is the one who is going to save, that the Lord is the one who is going to save them. And he does by his mighty hand and his outstretched arm. This is the story of Israel. It's also the story of the entire Bible. Galatians 4, verse 4 says, "When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law." In Genesis 3:15, it was pronounced that one of the offspring of Eve would crush the head of Satan. I didn't tell you this last week, and I was reminded of that a few times, that this verse is called the Proto-Euangelion, which means the first gospel in Genesis 3:15. This hope that one day a child would be born who would end this war against sin. And then finally, we get to Jesus Christ in the fullness of time, born of a woman, who grows up and crushes the head of Satan on the cross, where he himself is crucified and buried. And on the third day, he rises again. The war against sin is not won through human effort, but through God's action. He saves people who call on the name of the Lord. We can work as hard as we want to try to overcome sin, but we're only going to be disappointed. But if we wait for God to act, then we will see the salvation of the Lord. Romans chapter 10 says that if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. This is the story of the Bible. It's also my story. So many of you know it at this point, but it fits so well here, I have to tell it one more time. Last Friday, 38 years ago, a beautiful baby girl was born in Fargo, North Dakota, who was severely handicapped. That was my sister, Angela. At that time, my parents were very far from God. Didn't factor God into any of the decisions they had made, and they had no intention of giving him any credit for whatever gifts they had been given in their lives. But God was preparing them so that when my sister Angie was born, my father didn't know what to do because they didn't know what was going to happen to her. And he found himself in a church, and he heard a preacher tell him that if he confessed that Jesus was Lord, and if he believed in his heart that God raised him from the dead, he would be saved. And that day, the day after my sister was born, my dad gave his heart to God. He used this little baby that was born to him. God uses things that often surprise us, and to remind us that it's not going to be through anything that we do but it's going to be through his action. If you don't know where you stand with the Lord, if you're here this morning and you say, I don't know if I've called on the name of the Lord, I don't know if I am saved, then I want to encourage you to talk to me or talk to someone who you think might know how you might be able to put your faith in Jesus Christ. And if you have done that, then take a moment to just thank God for the fact that despite all of the things that you have done, he sent his son to this earth to save you, to open up your eyes to see him and to bring you to himself. You know, Bethlehem, the town where Jesus was born, means house of bread. And Jesus Christ was, after he was born, was placed in a feeding trough, a manger. And when he grew up, he told the world that he was the bread of life. And then on the night he was betrayed, he took bread and he gave it to his disciples and says, take and eat. This is my body, which is for you. As a community, we are going to celebrate communion together and remember the sacrifice that Jesus made for us. As the servers come forward, take a moment right now to pray silently before the Lord. Consider where you are with him. If you don't know, then ask that he would reveal himself to you. And if you do know, then spend some time thanking God that he saved you not because of your effort, but because of his action. And then in a moment we will partake together.